DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. I'm Neil King, your host today, speaking to you from Bonn, Germany. In the first half of this week's edition of Worldlink, we'll be focusing on personal stories from the Americas. We'll be taking you to the US Rust Belt, where people are taking stock of Donald Trump's first 100 days in office.
He doesn't lie. He tells us what it's going to be. He's very smart, and he doesn't let anybody crap on him. And that's what's amazing.
We'll also be taking a look at Venezuela's protest movement as the country inches closer to economic collapse. Plus, how former FARC guerrillas in Colombia are managing the transition to civilian life after decades of armed conflict. All that and more coming up on Worldlink. You're listening to DW's Worldlink with me, Neil King. And we start the programme in the US. The 29th of April marks 100 days since Donald Trump took office as the 45th President of the United States. Unsurprisingly, diehard Trump supporters and critics have a very different take on how successful he's been so far. Yet most of Trump's more controversial campaign promises have not been implemented, partly due to stiff resistance and partly because Trump himself has altered course on a number of issues since taking office. So what about the American voters who placed their faith in Trump when he pledged it would be America first from now on? The Midwest played a crucial part in handing Donald Trump the presidency last year, and many blue-collar workers there who used to vote for the Democrats changed sides in the election amid growing disillusionment with the political establishment and Trump's promise of clawing back jobs for Americans laid out in his America First doctrine. It resonated with many there, especially in the Rust Belt, the industrial heart of the United States, where people feel their industries and jobs are being sacrificed on the altar of globalization. Marijke Arden travelled to the city of Youngstown in Ohio to find out how Trump voters there feel about their president's performance so far.
Southside Recycling, the big banner on the building reads in black letters on white. And underneath in red, armed security on premises at all times. I'm in Youngstown, Ohio, at a scrapyard. People drive into the garage-like building, and then the workers sort away the scrap pieces they bring in. Aluminium, steel, copper, or old electronics. Kenny Greco is in his 40s. He's the owner. He grew up here in the neighborhood called the South Side, which also serves as the name for his business.
You know, 27 years ago, you could walk these streets any time of day or night. You don't want to do that now. I mean, yes, there's still good people here. There's also some, you know, shooting every night.
With his business, Kenny Greco wants to bring change to the neighborhood from within, he says. The south side of Youngstown has changed over the last decades, as did the whole city.
It was one of the hubs of the steel industry, the Rust Belt, as they say. You know, to give you an example, a lot of the bombs made in the World Wars were manufactured here. The bridges, the beams. We had at one time countless mills along the river up until early 80s, late 70s, and everything just left. There's still a few, but nowhere near where it was. Everywhere else in America and the world had these new efficient mills, and Youngstown had these old clunkers, as you would say. And that was it. It went under. So, and once they went under, you had, you know, 80,000 people out of work.
Kenny Greco is also a musician. He used to dream about becoming a rock star. In Youngstown, people sort of know him. Kenny keeps his guitar in his office. To understand Youngstown better, I should listen to this song, he says. Sitting on a stack of cardboards, he starts playing a song Bruce Springsteen wrote about the town. It's about the crisis of the steel industry, about hard-working people who feel forgotten and abandoned. He lived that song, Kenny says. My sweet Jenny, I'm sick getting down. For decades, Youngstown was a stronghold for the Democrats. But in the last elections, they barely won. Donald Trump gained a lot of ground, and Kenny says that is no surprise.
When you look around the city, it's abandoned, it's deserted, it's falling apart. The roads are falling apart, the bridges are falling apart. No new business, no new schools, no new innovation. And I think finally, the people of this area had it. So basically the Democrats took this area for granted.
And so many blue-collar workers here voted for change and Donald Trump. Kenny says he was on the fence for Trump but couldn't vote for him. Something held him back. Probably, he says, because he has the impression that Trump isn't a good man. So Kenny didn't vote at all. There are many things he doesn't like about the new president, like the tweeting and that he's not acting presidential, but...
I'm giving him a fair shot. I think the media is not. I think the media is rigged. They do nothing but tear him down. It's comical.
Kenny Greco says 100 days is too early to judge. However, things aren't going too bad for Trump, Kenny thinks. From what he hears around town and from his customers, Trump's voters are content too.
I would say the people that were on the fence with Trump are now for him. His supporters are now more emboldened. And what has he done? He has pushed back, you know, Assad, he took out the airfield. Anyone who isn't for that, I would be worried about. Like, you have to respond to someone who kills innocent children. And the previous administration didn't, and Assad did what he wanted to. You have to push back. In addition, Trump has already started to make these factories liable for shipping jobs over to other countries.
Okay, that means it's been put in.
Just go through them.
A couple of miles further south are the headquarters of the Republican Party in Mahoning County, which Youngstown is part of. Trump won Ohio, but couldn't quite win this county yet. Connie Spagnola is sitting in front of a computer in the headquarters, updating the database of new Republican supporters to make sure to reach them with emails. She's in her 60s, a former hairdresser and a former Democrat. The day after Trump announced his bid for the presidency, she started volunteering for him and the Republican Party. His first 100 days in office have been great, Connie tells me.
It's so exciting. Every morning I wake up and knowing that he's our president just gives me a thrill. I mean, the man is absolutely right on. He doesn't lie. He tells us what it's going to be. If he goes ahead and bombs something, then he did it because he had to. He's just an amazing man. He's very smart. And he doesn't let anybody crap on him. And that's what's amazing.
Connie is for the wall, mainly to keep drugs out of the country, she says, and she's happy Trump hasn't abandoned that plan. Connie says she was sorry to see that Obamacare hasn't been repealed and replaced yet, but she blames the Republicans, not Trump, for that. She's convinced support for him is growing. Here, voters want to switch their party registration even now.
I mean, the people that come in here and just sit and talk about how well he's doing and what he's doing. And we have never seen this before. And I've had 14 calls. That's within the last 4 weeks. I had 14 calls so far about people who want to change. I think that's marvelous because they see what he's doing.
Once a month on the 15th, her group of female volunteers sends a letter or a greeting card to the White House to thank Donald Trump. Also once a month, they organize a pro-Trump protest to show their support. And Connie has a weekly prayer group.
We pray for only Trump, his cabinet, his family, Vice President Pence, his family, and for world peace. Now, after the meeting, some of the girls get together and they pray for their friends or something, you know, somebody that has cancer. I won't stop that. But the main thing that we have for our prayer night is Mr. Trump. And he needs all the prayers he can get. Because the media is kind of a bunch of liars. They never say the truth, they make up stories.
Back over at the scrapyard, Kenny Greco says there are two Americas.
There's America, and then there's California and New York. Really? California and New York are very liberal, very worldview, very wealthy. So in between California and New York, you've got America who works, tries to save for their kids' college, struggles to pay their bills, and lives in what I call real life. So that's where the Democrats have missed, and that's where Trump tapped into it. I'm not saying he's a good man, but he's a very resolute man.
And Youngstown, with its withering steel industry and abandoned buildings, is nothing like New York or California, Kenny says. He expects that Trump's approval rating will go up, not only here in Youngstown, but also in other parts of what he calls the real-life America. Mareike Aden, DW, Youngstown, Ohio.
We now move to South America, to a country whose economy is in far worse shape than America's Rust Belt right now. Venezuela used to be one of South America's richest nations thanks to its vast oil reserves, but now it's close to economic and political meltdown. The economy shrank by a whopping 18% last year. Inflation is at over 700%. That's the highest rate in the world right now. Staple products are scarce or unaffordable. Add to this rampant crime and corruption, and it's no surprise that many people are taking to the streets. Anti-government protests have been flaring across the country this past month, and the unrest has already claimed the lives of over 26 people. But the embattled socialist president Nicolas Maduro won't back down and is blaming the crisis on a US-led conspiracy. Earlier, I spoke to journalist Mariana Zuniga, who's been covering the protests in the capital, Caracas.
The situation is really tense between security forces and protesters because the repression has become very, very hard. There's a lot of tear gas being thrown to the protester in a very indiscriminated way, and the death toll is now, if I'm not wrong, 29 people, and the detention, around 1,000 people have been detained during this month.
And your voice, Mariana, I mean, you do sound rather hoarse. That's because of all the tear gas that's being fired at these protests, right?
A little bit of that, even though I always use a mask to protect myself. And because journalists and people in general, we haven't left the street during almost a month. There's a protest practically every day in the capital.
Can you please describe the protest movement?
We can see the whole opposition together trying to ask for something. And it was triggered by, because the Supreme Court tried to seize power from the Congress that is in its majority composed by members of the opposition.
And what have the protesters been telling you? That, I mean, the deaths, they haven't put them off protesting, have they?
No, and this is the first time. I've heard many things. I met this lady, she's around 60, her name is Josefina Rodriguez, and she told me that this was the very first time she went out and protested.
Nunca fui una marcha, pero llegó.
This is the first time in my life I'm out protesting, because I've had enough. We're living in such a precarious situation. There's no food, no medicines, and the crime rate is out of control. So I decided to join for the first time. I'm not protesting every day, because I'm an old lady and sometimes it's too much for me. Also, the security forces are really cracking down on us. But I go at least once a week.
Mariana, did you meet many people like Josefina who are out protesting for the very first time in their lives?
Yes, I met a lot of people that is protesting for the very first time, because what is particular in this protest is that you can see a melting pot of the whole society for the first time. Now we're seeing different ages and different parts of the society participating in the same protest.
Mm-hmm. And protests like Josefina, they say they can't take anymore. Can you please give us some examples from everyday life to illustrate just how bad the situation has become for everyday Venezuelans?
Well, if you're out with your car or walking in the street, it won't be weird for you to see somebody looking in the trash to find something to eat. Another very maybe outrageous example is that many women are looking to be sterilized in Venezuela because they can't afford to have more children anymore. So because in Venezuela abortion is not legal, they are looking just to stop, also because they can't find the pills or the condoms, to not even in the black market. So having a baby is a very stressful situation in today's Venezuela. There's no diapers or no formula or no milk to nourish your kids. So you see a lot of mothers doing this kind of procedure.
I also read that a bottle of water costs as much as 250 liters of petrol. Is that correct?
It is correct. Also, to buy some kind of medicine now, those medicines that are not in shortage, those that are arriving in the country, it's sometimes it could be half of the minimum wage. So people can't even afford it now. We've been looking for months for a medicine for hypertension, I think, for my grandmother, and it has been very difficult.
So how long can you keep going like this?
To be honest, it's very difficult to predict how long people can stay in the street. It's an exercise of resistance. And when they have, and this I say it as a citizen and not as a journalist, but when they have the arms and you as a citizen, you don't have anything, it's very difficult to stay in the street under those conditions. I'm not saying that people have to have arms to defend themselves, but it's just very difficult keep like receiving repression and not obtaining much.
So, Mariana, what's the solution? Maduro steps down and calls a snap election? Would that really solve the problem?
I would love to give you a solution, Neil, to be honest. At this point, I really don't know. I think the wiser thing will be to call elections and make people decide what they want. The problem is that there's also a part of the population that they don't identify with the government nor with the opposition. So I interviewed them and they said that they will not vote. If there's a vote tomorrow and there's someone from the opposition and someone from the government, they just will stay at home and not vote. So I don't think that's good either. So to be honest, at this point, I don't know what could happen.
That was journalist Mariana Zuniga speaking to me about the Venezuelan crisis from Caracas. And if you want to stay up to speed with the current crisis in Venezuela or any other breaking news, visit our website at dw.com. And we stay in Latin America for our next story. After half a century of conflict that has left 220,000 dead and nearly 7 million displaced, Colombia's FARC rebels are now laying down their weapons in camps across the country. The peace process currently underway was negotiated over 4 years in the Cuban capital of Havana. The rebels, who took up arms supposedly in defense of peasant farmers, soon turned to drug trafficking, kidnapping and extortion to fund their political goals. Now, they are preparing to leave it all behind. Currently, some 7,000 Marxist FARC fighters are in designated camps across Colombia, where they are preparing for civilian life after generations of war. Joe Parkin Daniels went to meet with some of them and see how this transition is working out.
Viviana Duarte joined the FARC, Colombia's largest rebel army, when she was 13. She looks gentle and unassuming. With her glasses and soft tone, she could easily be mistaken for a Bogota office worker. However, for the past 16 years of her life, Viviana has known only war. She's talking to me at a demobilization camp in Puerto Asís, in Colombia's southern Putumayo province, on the jungle border with Ecuador.
The guerrilla arrived in our town. My mother wanted to send me away to Bogota, but I didn't want to go. I wanted to live in another world, to live another distinct life. I wanted to know what the guerrillas were like.
At only 13 years old, the rebels were reluctant to let Viviana join, but she managed to convince them after a probation period. Like many young girls who joined the FARC, Viviana was drawn to the equality they allowed female recruits, something alien to Colombia's patriarchal society.
It didn't scare me because I saw many young women and I wanted to be like them. I wanted to be one of those women that carried a rifle. I saw these young women and they were beautiful, but beautiful in the sense that they were strong. They carried the packs into combat, they carried rifles. They were doing all these adult things, but still being children, teenagers. I wanted to be one of them.
After 52 years of a conflict that has left 220,000 dead and nearly 7 million displaced, Viviana and her 7,000 comrades in the FARC are now laying down their weapons following a peace deal agreed last year. Viviana lost her husband in combat and is now looking forward to civilian life. She is studying communications with hopes to one day be a journalist.
Lo que hacemos ahora aquí, por ejemplo, yo me encuentro en la zona veredal La Carmelita.
I am in the La Carmelita demobilization camp in Putumayo. I'm from the Caquetá department. They delegated three fronts to do a course in communications here. We are currently doing a course which is going to last 3 months. We are publishing reports one or two a day on what happens.
Lo que suceda.
Viviana and her team of budding journalists have published reports on the conditions in the camp and on the recent visit of the Colombian president. Elsewhere in the camp, rebels are learning basic medicine, social media skills, and cookery.
Es una forma de vida ya afuera que vayamos a tener cada uno de nosotros.
It's a way of life that each of us are going to have outside. So with all the courses and workshops that we have here, we have to take advantage of them to the maximum. Because all this time, in all these 53 years of conflict, we have never had this opportunity, and the majority of us don't have an education.
No tenemos estudio.
Across the camp, where rebels are building makeshift houses to see them through the rainy winter, FARC member Robinson Castro, a 36-year-old who has spent the last 15 years with the guerrilla, is running a bakery that serves the camp.
Ahí vamos entre todos aprendiendo y adquiriendo cada día más conocimientos.
Every day we're learning more. And why are we learning? So we can be something in the future. So they can't say that we're just guerrilleros. No. Instead, they can say he was a guerrillero, but now he's a baker.
Colombia's efforts to achieve a peace deal earned the country's president, Juan Manuel Santos, the 2016 Nobel Prize for Peace. However, the road to peace was fraught with tense negotiations and initially failed to pass a public referendum last October, being defeated by the narrowest of margins. Martin Corena remembers that night well. He's the commander of the FARC's Southern Bloc, one of the guerrilla army's largest and most militarily organized divisions. At 63 years old, he is one of the oldest in the camp, and having spent 41 years with the rebels, one of the most experienced.
Making a frank and sincere analysis, the No camp winning was beneficial to the Colombian people. After the No won, the people realized the fraud and the mechanisms, and it galvanized them into moving forward towards peace.
Martín hopes that now that the FARC are no longer a military operation, they will be able to pursue their goals for social reform through politics.
There we will form a political party, we will form a strong movement of masses, and we're going to work politically for the fields and for the cities, consolidating this political movement born in the FARC, and in the future we'll be a force to be reckoned with. Our aim is to govern.
However, in order to bolster their war chest during the armed conflict, the FARC turned to the drug trade and to kidnapping, as well as extorting locals in territories they controlled. It was this strategy that saw the rebel group listed on both the European Union and United States international terrorist lists, as well as alienating them from the rural farmers they claimed to represent. FARC members view many of these accusations as coming from a media closely aligned with the state. Despite the challenges ahead of reintegration, the majority of rebels in Puerto Asís are excited about a new chapter in their lives and about living in peace for the first time. For Viviana, this means finding her family.
Lo primero que voy a hacer cuando salgamos ya, o sea, se cumplen los 180 días.
The first thing I'm going to do when I leave here after the 180 days? Well, the idea is that we will have the opportunity to stay here or to leave. So I'm going to stay here working with communications as a member of the political party. And the other thing is I will contact my family, look for them, because I haven't heard from them in 17 years. I never called them, not my mum or my dad, nor my brothers. I haven't done it because I haven't been able to.
Joe Parkin Daniels for DW in Puerto Asís, Colombia.
We now head into a short music break before changing gears in the second half of the programme, where we'll be looking at the issues of migration and integration. Just a reminder, you can find the full Worldlink programme at dw.com/Worldlink or on iTunes. You can also find some pictures to some of our Worldlink reports on our Global Society Facebook page. I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany, and this is DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. You're listening to DW's Worldlink. My name is Neil King. In this second half of the programme, we'll be looking into personal stories about migration and integration. We find out why some sub-Saharan Africans who set out to reach Europe are staying in Morocco instead. We also meet some unaccompanied refugee children from Afghanistan, stranded in Serbia after taking the Balkan route. And we introduce you to a unique choir in Canada that is helping refugees from across the globe find their voice again.
When we are singing, is we are one. That is what is my feeling. It doesn't matter where you're from, your accent, whatever. It's we are one.
Those stories and more coming up on Worldlink. And we start in Morocco. Sub-Saharan Africans who want to reach Europe often use Morocco as a country of transit. After arriving in this North African state, they frequently attempt to reach Spain or other European countries by risking their lives in a dangerous crossing of the Mediterranean Sea. But recently, many migrants have decided not to attempt to reach Europe at all, and instead, they are starting a new life in Morocco itself. Guy Hetchko met with some of them in Casablanca to find out what made them change their minds.
This is Casablanca's bustling central souk, but it's a section of the market where you don't see that many Moroccans. Instead, almost all those who work here are from countries across sub-Saharan Africa, such as Ivory Coast, Guinea and Cameroon. Richard Wenong is a Cameroonian electrician who works around the market, and his wife has a beauty parlour there.
Firstly, I came to Morocco because I wished to travel to Europe, but finally I saw that it was not important for me because I got some jobs that I can do since I'm a technician. I finally integrated myself here, so things are moving well with me, no need for me to look for Europe.
In the last 4 years, thousands of sub-Saharans have managed to gain Moroccan residency papers following two migrant legalization initiatives led by the government. Richard is one of nearly 20,000 migrants currently waiting for their papers to be processed.
Do you know other people from Cameroon who have gone to Europe?
Yeah, many.
And how are they doing?
Very, very difficult. Very, very. Some lost their life, some succeed. It's very difficult.
I'm now on a train heading north to the capital, Rabat, where a local association is helping fund small businesses, and among them are enterprises set up by sub-Saharan Africans.
À tous et à toutes, bonjour.
Mohamed Mboyo is originally from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. A journalist, he came here in 2013, fleeing political persecution, and now has his own show on Moroccan radio.
Brûlant de l'actualité. Ainsi, je vous invite à être attentif.
In a condition to leave my country due to the lack of democracy and conflict in my country. You know, Democratic Republic of Congo is a troubled zone now, and I've been working as journalist in my country, and I face some threats from the government. I have to leave the country to save my life.
Mohamed has received support from AMAP, an association that helps small businesses. It offers advice, financing and training to self-employed workers. And one of its projects helps immigrants, many of them sub-Saharan Africans.
AMAP granted me their financial support. They bought for me a computer, an important tool for a journalist.
How difficult is it? How much of a challenge is it for someone from the Democratic Republic of Congo to integrate into society in Morocco and Moroccan life?
I can say that in Morocco, when you speak French, you can try your best, you can find a job, you can manage life.
Hassan Erifai, who works for AMAP, explains how many migrants have changed their view of Morocco in recent years.
Les choses ont changé. Le migrant, pour le moment, il se considère comme s'il est chez lui. Et non pas dans
Things have changed. Immigrants consider themselves at home here and not in another country. And this has given the migrant or the refugee the feeling of belonging to a country whose culture they share as well. And so in this way, Morocco has become a host country and not just a transit country.
Donc un pays d'accueil et non pas un pays juste un pays de transit.
Even though the legalization of thousands of sub-Saharans represents a major shift in policy in Morocco, judging by the reaction of these university students in Rabat, it's a change that many people here welcome.
I think it's normal. We do the same in other countries like France and America, so I think it's just normal. If they are good at their job, they will impact the economy. It will be better, for sure.
I'm really open to all other people from other nationalities to come to Morocco to study or to get a job, to work. So there are just some minority of Moroccans that are intolerant to people coming from other countries.
Moroccan GDP is currently growing faster than that of many European countries. And after years of leaving here as quickly as they could, sub-Saharan Africans are now playing an increasingly important role in Morocco's economy and its society. Guy Hedgeco, DW, Morocco.
Next up, we look into how stranded child refugees are coping in makeshift shelters in Serbia. But first, a little bit of music.
Whisper now and tell me how you want.
humanitarian aid organisations are ringing alarm bells about the dire conditions in which child refugees live along the former Balkan route. An estimated 1,300 unaccompanied minors are facing violence, extortion and abuse while travelling through Bulgaria, Macedonia, Serbia and Croatia. Thousands of refugees, many of which are minors travelling alone, are stuck in Serbia because the borders with Hungary and Croatia are closed. Mitra Nazar found some of them in an abandoned warehouse in the Serbian capital.
There is about 300. Sometimes there is more. But 300 is something that is steady number.
Unaccompanied.
Unaccompanied minors, yes. In this moment, the number is increased because we had some new arrivals. We had a few periods where the more than a half of population were minors, unaccompanied minors.
I'm behind the train station in Belgrade. Refugees have found shelter here for over a year now, in empty, rundown factory barracks. Around 300 unaccompanied minors are sleeping rough here, amongst the rats and without proper hygiene. I'm going in with outreach worker Mirjana Nesic.
This one, four of them. This one is not.
How old are you?
Ten.
Yes. Where do you come from? Afghanistan?
Afghanistan, yes.
Where is your mother, father?
Afghanistan. No, Afghanistan.
This boy is only 10 years old. His parents had sent him on the road to Europe to escape dire living conditions and threats by the Taliban in Afghanistan. He's traveling with an older cousin in a group of young men. He arrived in Serbia after having traveled through Iran, Turkey and Bulgaria for months. He says he's on his way to London, where his older brother lives. In Bulgaria, he cried a lot, an older boy from the group tells me. He got beaten by the police there. In Serbia, he says, it's better.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Afternoon.
So you got up early.
Mirjana is a social worker from the local NGO Praxis. Every day she goes through the barracks in search of unaccompanied minors. She counts them, talks to them and offers help where she can. Sometimes she manages to bring them to safety in one of the country's official reception centers. But often these minors refuse to leave the group, she tells me.
They start together, they don't want to get separated. In our system, they would be separated. I don't know. I couldn't imagine my kids in this kind of situation. I mean, they are very brave. They are very smart kids. But they are still children. When they're in the trouble, yeah, then you can see how childish they are. They just give up and they put the whole their life in your hands, you know. And then you put them in the camp.
The Balkan route is far from closed, says Ivan Miskovic from the Serbian government's Commissariat for Refugees and Migration.
We have new arrivals every day. We have more than 6,000 migrants accommodated. More than 6,000 frustrated people residing unwillingly on our territory. And I believe becoming more and more aware of the fact that they won't be able to continue their journey. They are stranded. That their prospects are not that good at this moment, I have to say.
The government does everything in its power to take these kids from the streets, he says, but it's a difficult task.
So far, we've conducted so many activities trying to persuade them to give them all the information that they shouldn't be in those informal sites, because these are the conditions which are not suitable for providing any kind of help, you know. And I witnessed myself that the uncle of a guy who was maybe 9 or 10 refused to go to any of the centers. He said that he wanted to stay in those barracks. He was persisting in staying there with his young relative. And you can't force anybody, you know.
Hello, how are you?
How old is he?
10. Yes.
14.
You are nothing.
Is he alone?
Here. He's my friend. He's
your
from
friend?
Pakistan.
In Serbia?
You're from Afghanistan.
Okay.
Sleep and meals, you also here.
He's very young?
Yeah.
Is he okay?
Yeah, okay. He is my brother. I'm Pakistani.
Humanitarian organizations like Save the Children are trying to help these children as much as they can. They have a drop-in center in Belgrade where they offer activities, food and also psychological help, says Jelena Besedic from Save the Children.
The journey itself is very stressful. It is very traumatic and it affects their mental health. The children here, that we have seen a lot of now with the borders more firmly closed and they're spending more time in Serbia, we have seen a lot of cases of self-harm and mental health problems with children because they are losing hope, they're losing money, they have been trying on many occasions to continue the journey, they've been pushed back by the police on various borders, they have been beaten up, in some cases don't have enough money to contact their family, they feel lost, they're all alone.
Reports of abuse, robberies and illegal pushbacks mostly come from EU countries Hungary, Croatia and Bulgaria. Bulgaria is pushing refugees onward to Serbia. Croatia and Hungary are pushing them back to Serbia, unaccompanied minors included, Besedic from Save the Children tells me.
So what I think is needed is for the European Union to create some sort of an agenda, some sort of strategic plan how to deal with these children who are traveling, instead of saying that the borders are closed and therefore nobody's coming while they are coming. So
the European Union has recently appealed to their member states to do more to protect the unaccompanied children who reach their countries. But it doesn't help the minors who are currently stuck in Serbia, which is not an EU country. And as long as there is no structural solution, they will continue to face violence and extortion along the routes they are traveling. Mitra Nazar for DW in Belgrade.
Our next story is about a project that may not offer any structural solution to the refugee crisis, but it certainly offers hope that a solution can be found if we all pull together. In Ottawa, Canada, refugees and immigrants, originally from Syria, Liberia, Colombia, China, Kuwait and other countries, have come together to form the World Voices Choir. It's helping them get settled into Canadian life, make new friends, improve their English, and in some cases heal from past trauma, and discover hidden musical talents. This multilingual, multi-ethnic and multi-faith choir hopes audiences will welcome their positive message of inclusion, and that when people from different cultures and backgrounds stand together, they can make beautiful music. Sian Griffiths recently attended a choir practice.
At an Ottawa community centre, conductor Chris McLean leads choir members in a warm-up to warm up those vocal chords.
One, one, two, one, one, two, two, one.
Loosen up the muscles in the face. And generally release all those tensions which have built up during the week. And very quickly, everyone is laughing, relaxed, and ready to sing. It's a cheerful atmosphere in anticipation of the music they'll be making together.
Bambalela, bambalela, oh, bambalela.
People in this choir really love singing Bambalela. It's a South African freedom song, and it basically means never give up. And right from the beginning, they loved singing it.
Conductor Chris picks songs from different cultures from all over the world and in different languages, each one carrying a positive message of inclusion, unity, and peace.
Yes, I do want songs that are uplifting. I think we live in tumultuous times and people are bombarded by bad news. So when they come to choir, I want it to be about good news and about connectivity and compassion and the things that bring us together.
Chris, a folk singer who conducts three other choirs, had been thinking about setting up a world choir for a while, but recent events made her realize how much a group like this was needed now.
The whole situation with the Syrian refugees coming became more and more and more in our face. And so this is one way for us to contribute to making the transition for them perhaps a little bit more enjoyable. Because I can only empathize, they must be traumatized, exhausted, confused. Not the little kids, but the parents. They're really, it must be horrendously difficult.
Choir members aren't expected to have great voices or even to know English. In fact, some come hoping to improve their English, like 14-year-old Khaled from Syria, one of a few children in the choir.
I need to practice for English. I like singing in English and Arabic.
And he's not the youngest in the choir either. That would be 9-year-old Hassan, Khaled's little brother. Fellow choir member Mohammed and his family spent 3 years in a Jordanian refugee camp after fleeing the war in Syria. In peacetime, he was a nurse, a barber, an artist, and he also taught kindergarten children how to sing. Being able to resume his singing passion has been very healing for Mohammed.
I feel very rest after singing, and I am artist, me. I feel very nice after this. I need this, always I need. I feel the peace, okay?
Nadia's family came from Kuwait in the early 1990s, after the end of the Gulf War. Her country had suffered under the occupation of Saddam Hussein. Post-war life was difficult, she said. The family decided to make a fresh start and came to Canada. She's employed by the choir as an administrator and initially had no interest in singing, but the lure of the music was just too powerful, and it's allowed her to discover hidden talents.
I like singing with them. They are an amazing group.
And could you sing before?
I discovered myself.
Tell us more.
Yeah, actually, I was a really shy person. So when I came here, I was kind of going behind the participant and sing because I don't feel confidence to go there in the front. But step by step, I find myself like, okay, you can go. You can do it. You can sing. You can just show your face to them. I just remember one sentence that my friends told me before. She said, face your fears. Your fears will disappear. So this is what exactly I did. I faced everything, so now I'm not shy anymore. I can sing.
The multilingual, multicultural nature of the choir and its repertoire was a big draw for Tanja and Zaria from northeast China. She moved to Canada as part of a family reunion.
I've been searching this kind of choir for a while. This is a very cool opportunity to meet different people from different cultures and different religions. Yeah, we sing songs in different languages about peace and be kind to each other. Yeah.
Jeanette's family fled the threat of kidnapping squads in Colombia. Many of her friends had been abducted and left traumatized, she said. She wanted somewhere safe to raise her children. She's been in Canada for 15 years now, and knowing how hard it can be to integrate, thought she could help smooth the way for newcomers.
New people that are coming need to be together with other immigrants, that they can see, okay, well, it's going to be easier, because at the beginning it's a big, big thing. I came just for curiosity. I got in love with the group, the people, the songs, everything, yeah.
Matarange fled civil war in Liberia in the 1990s. After she spent 24 years in neighboring Ivory Coast, she came to Canada. Despite her traumatic past, she brings an infectious sense of joy to the choir. She's only been here 6 months, but she says the choir has been a great way to meet new friends, and she's found it all very liberating.
Yeah, I feel happy and I feel free. I enjoy the choir, how we all together, and we all friendly, dancing, singing. I love dancing.
She gets the chance to move to the African beats of her favorite song, Bambalela.
Bambalela.
One of the negative features of the rise of populism in both Europe and the United States has been increasing anti-refugee and anti-immigrant rhetoric. Conductor Chris hopes that the World Voices Choir helps to dispel negative perceptions when they share their music.
I want them to take away the knowing that people from other cultures are not terrorists, that they are wonderful people just like we are.
And choir members also hope to win over hearts and minds with their message of inclusion, tolerance, and acceptance as they sing in harmony.
It's like a family with people who are from different cultural backgrounds and from different religions, and all get together with no distance, have common similarities, even though we might look different.
When we are singing, we are one. That is is my feeling. It doesn't matter where you're from, your accent, whatever. We are one.
Refugee, very, very simple. I now just come in here for a search for chance live. I want a live in peace, please, and war. No, refugee very simple, very tired for what happened in Syria.
Chris admits that being involved with this choir has been an emotional experience.
It amazes me that I'm not in tears more often because it really moves me to see the people singing together and the camaraderie that's developed between them. And it amazes me that they keep coming back. You know, they it seems like this is like a extended family in a way. I don't know. It all amazes me. It's fabulous.
Before the choir breaks for the evening, its members gather in a circle and hold hands to send out one musical plea for unity. Shan Griffiths for DW in Ottawa.
Time now to hop back over the pond to Berlin for our regular WorldLink column. In this year of elections across Europe, there is no escaping the noise of the immigration issue. But what of its quieter, yet incredibly close cousin, the integration issue? Sure, the word rings familiar, but what do we really know of the worlds, concepts and wishes encompassed in those four tiny syllables? WorldLink columnist Tamsin Walker went in search of answers in Berlin.
Listen carefully. This may sound like the cacophony of any old chatter, but I'd like to think there's more to it, and that it is, in fact, closer to Babel than Babel, and quite possibly integration in the making. I say possibly, because if I'm being completely honest, I'd have to admit I'm not entirely sure what the word means. That's not to say I fail to grasp its definition, though it does vary depending on your dictionary of choice, but that its usage in the contemporary climate of immigration versus anti-immigration begs as many questions as it offers answers.
Wir werden eine Reihe von Maßnahmen treffen, die deutlich machen, es gibt eine
Pflicht. I'm obviously not the only one for whom that concept isn't entirely clear. Last year, the German government passed an integration law, which aims to clarify the issue, setting out the respective rights and obligations of both refugees and the state. A key aspect of the novel legislation are integration classes, which offer their students insight into the history, values, and legal system of the host country. Asylum seekers are expected to attend, and failure to do so, without a good reason at least, results in reduced financial support. I'd like to think their inception would put pay to the facile right-wing populist refrain about job-stealing, system-milking opportunists marching across the border with outstretched palms and being handed charmed lives. But it probably doesn't, because us humans, we hear what we want to hear. And those who insist that new arrivals have come to take advantage are unlikely to be swayed to reconsider their bias by integration classes.
Where do you live?
Wo wohnen Sie?
I live in Berlin.
Or, for that matter, by the language courses, which asylum seekers are also required to attend. For the record, I think them a good thing, and that newcomers with non-refugee backgrounds would be equally well advised to learn about the fickle nature of the German article, or make that articles, if they're planning to stay. Which brings me back to Babel, aka a Berlin room filled with young refugees and students from all over the world, who've come together to share stories of the city and country they now call home. Listening to them speak, I was amazed at how quickly some have mastered the complexities of the language.
Ich komme aus wunderbarem Land. Ich komme aus Syrien. Besonders aus Damaskus.
Greif, a young Syrian with a big smile and a background in computer engineering, is a case in point. He's been learning German since he arrived here a year and 3 months ago, and it trips off his tongue with what for many would be enviable ease.
Ich habe mehrmals versucht einen Job zu finden und habe ich mehr als 300 E-Mails geschickt zu vielen Firmen in Berlin und ich.
He used his newly acquired linguistic skills to tell me about his 300 job applications and 4 resulting interviews. Though he hasn't struck lucky yet, he has, he says, learned from the experience and will be better prepared the next time.
Seit einem Monat habe ich das Praktikum angefangen.
I found his determination humbling. He hasn't been handed a perfect existence, but like any of us who arrive in Germany from elsewhere, he's been presented with an opportunity to find a way into a foreign society. An opportunity that he and so many others are making the most of. And ultimately, regardless of the new guidelines, and regardless of whether somebody is a refugee or not, I believe it's that level of personal commitment that will help determine the success of Germany's integration project. It may, in fact, prove integral.
And Tamsin Walker's column wraps up this week's edition of Worldlink. We hope you enjoyed the show and will also find the time to check out our Global Society Facebook page and DW website for more stories and multimedia content. This week's Worldlink was produced by me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Håkan Zieder. Don't forget that you can find all our episodes at dw.com/worldlink on SoundCloud, under DW English, or on iTunes. Worldlink was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.
Here I go, out to sea again. The sunshine fills my head and dreams.